place where the density is infinity and the velocity is zero. Here is the equation which applies up, which is the distance between the singularity and the end of the platform. Here we get the radius, that's the distance, and it's directly proportional to the mass. So here we calculate the acceleration of the black hole.
Okay, I'm going to be telling you about thermodynamics. So, thermodynamics is the study of the process that involves heat transfer. And there's two laws that we're going to tell you about. The first is conservation of energy. You can see the formula there. The delta U is the change in internal energy of the system. Q is the heat added to the system. And then it's minus the work done by the system. So that's the law of conservation of energy. Basically, it means that you can't lose energy. The second law is basically entropy. Very basically, heat flows from the hot to the cold. I guess everybody knows that. As you can see from the diagrams here, we have hot, we have cold. So when the heat goes to the cold, we have medium temperature. Of course.
like that. So everyone, and also everyone up the back. So John, Carlos especially, because it's a very big theater and it's very hard to hear. So.
Right.
So Nomani's.
Okay, so over the course of our mentoring session, we were thrust into the very exciting world of simple harmonic oscillators, fermions, bosons, and duality. And while this caused a lot of confusion, headaches, and there was a lot of math problems, we found that our problem consisted of a very interesting concept, which is called duality. And so duality is, typically it's a relationship between two very different looking theories. And these theories can both be used to describe one system. And what you want to do is you want to make it so that both of these theories are kind of in the same language so that they both can describe the system well. And in order to do this, you need to translate them and using a dictionary. And the dictionary that translates the two theories to make them both work is called duality. And so here's Mariette to give you some more information about that.
Right, so our project is based in one of the simplest yet extremely important models in classical mechanics, that is the simple harmonic oscillator. We may define simple harmonic oscillator, well, concretely harmonic oscillator, as any object that oscillates around equilibrium position, experiences a restoring force, and comes back to its initial position. The simple harmonic oscillator has no driving force and no friction. And you may know some examples are the simple pendulum and the spring or something like that. If the energy of the harmonic oscillator is of the order of h bar omega, that is, you know, h bar is Planck's constant over 2 pi, then we cannot ignore the quantum effects. So we have to talk about a quantum harmonic oscillator. We have to use a special formalism and use quantum mechanics. The systems in our project are included in this context since we're considering free particles moving in a harmonic oscillator. And well, roughly speaking, the elementary particles are fall into two groups, fermions and bosons. The fermions are those particles which satisfy Pauli's exclusion principle. And this principle says that no more than one fermion can occupy a single quantum state. So you know that energy is quantized. And in a harmonic oscillator, each particle has a fixed given energy level. So what this principle means is that we cannot have more than one particle with that same energy level. Some fermions are quarks or leptons, and bosons are those particles that aren't fermions. That means that they don't satisfy Pauli's exclusion principle. So that's like the definitions, the introduction, and now he will explain you the formalisms.
Okay, before I let Christoph explain the three systems that we are going to show dualism in between, I will first explain some of the background behind it so that you might be able to understand where he's coming from. Okay, first, when looking at the energy levels of systems, there are basically two formalisms which you can use to derive the possible energy states and the related energy levels. So the two formalisms are Schrodinger's and Heisenberg's. Basically, Schrodinger's is a wave function based formalism, and requires solving partial differential equations. However, for Heisenberg's model, it is based on matrices, in other words, linear algebra, and requires solving eigenvalue, eigenvector equations. In this case, because we are trying to avoid having to solve partial differential equations, we chose to use Heisenberg's formalism instead. Okay, so basically, in trying to look for the energy of an n-particle boson or fermion system, we first have to start somewhere with the energies of a system that we know. So basically, we know that the simple harmonic oscillator, we know the energy of the simple harmonic oscillator, so we will basically try and, starting from the energy of the simple harmonic oscillator, lead to the energies of the various systems that we intend to look at. So how would this be done? We'll try to follow the energy trails and relate the energies from one system to the other system. Okay, first we start with the known energy of the simple harmonic oscillator, which can be stated in this way. This is basically the saying that one part corresponds to kinetic energy and the other part corresponds to potential energy. So when we convert this into complex coordinates, this is what we get. Okay. After this, we manipulate these complex coordinates to give a certain operator. So this what an operator does, it basically it does a transformation of a state. So in this case, by manipulating Z and the other Z, we will get two operators. One operator is A and the other one is A dagger. So A is actually what people call the annihilation operator. What it does is when you have the energy levels, it performs a step down from one energy state to a lower one, and the creation operator does a opposite, which is a sort of a step up. So in this project, we showed that when you perform A on N, you get a lower state, which is N minus 1. Whereas when you do A dagger on N, you get N plus 1, which corresponds to the stepping up and stepping down. So further on, now that we know that the energy of the system can be expressed can be expressed as potential energy and kinetic energy. We then showed that this can be shown to be H bar omega and A dagger times A plus half. So by solving the eigenvalue eigenvector equation, we also showed that the energy corresponds to H bar N plus half. So this is where Christoph will use this in order to show certain results.
So we have worked on three various systems. They are all multi-particle systems that are in harmonic oscillations, but one is the system of fermions, and the other two are system of bosons. It's quite hard to keep it all at once in hands. Basically, we can draw the systems as energy levels. So, for example, the fermion system can be as the energy levels are discrete. Particles can't be between the energy levels, they can be only on certain ones. So the lowest energy possible is half H bar omega. It is not possible for such a particle to be below that level, because if it had no energy at all, it wouldn't satisfy the uncertainty principle. As Carl has already showed, the differences between the states are 1 h bar omega. So here we have 3 over 2, here we have 5 over 2 h bar omega. And we can also call this at certain levels with numbers, like 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 0, 1, 2, 3. Like that. Okay. And basically, we can place fermions of various levels of this. But as the fermions must satisfy the Pauli's exclusion principle, no two fermions can be in the same state. So, as the for example, first one is here, the second one can't be here. It must be on one of the others. For example, like that. The next system is for bosons. It is quite similar. We can also draw it like that. But in this case, many particles can be on the same systems, on the same level as they are bosons. It's hard to get to fit in time. Okay. There is also another system, the second system for bosons. It is for discrete space-time. And here we have the maximum energy that can't be, nothing can be above that. And we have some lowest energy, some states between them. And as they are bosons, we can place them anywhere. So they can be all on one. But the thing with this system is that also that the number of bosons isn't set. There can be only one, for example. Okay. I'm sorry, I can't fit in time. So I'll just show you some equations for energy. This is total energy in the first model. This is the one for ground states, and that's for everything that's above the ground state. If all the particles are in the minimum energy, then this is the minimum energy achievable for the first system, and this is the energy for the second model. And this is for third one. They won't be needed in what I'm talking about, but it will be used in the proof of Liu. We can introduce a number called n that we can to find some similarities between those models. We can introduce a number. It will count the number of particles here, and the maximum level in here. Okay, so let's say that I want to have a state three energy levels above the minimum. I can do it in many ways. For example, for the first model, there are three possibilities. I can have one on the ground, one on its. On its minimum, the third one was here, but I'll take it three levels up, 1, 2, 3, and here is three levels above the minimum. I can also do it another way. I can just leave one on the ground, pick one by one level up, and the other one by two levels up. I can also just move all of them by one level. So this all give the change of my three states. Okay, are we running, totally running out of time? Okay, so basically what I wanted to show more is that the same things can be done in these systems. And what's really important, what's the duality, is that one of these states corresponds to one of states in this model and one of states in this model. And for each model, for each state, there is such a duality. It won't be clearly seen as I didn't manage to show everything I wanted, but it can be looked at this way, that for that at the second model, when the levers that are here are the excitations of the fermions in the first model. It means that if everyone is on the zero, then everyone is at least at the less energetic level here. And in the last one, this can be. So maybe I'll give voice to that because. Yeah.
Okay. How long do I have? Okay. Okay. So we have three systems. One, the first one is for n hermions in the single harmonic oscillator. Second and third are both for bosons, but they are different. And our project is somehow to prove that the three systems are essentially the same mechanical, essentially identical. And to prove this, for the first system, we have n hermions and, hermions cannot stay in one energy level. Everyone has to be separate. So the lowest energy level is when, assume that we have three hermions. So the lowest energy level, which called ground energy level, is when all three are on the basis. They're at zero, energy level one, zero and one and two. And the ground energy level, the ground energy level calculated to be, if we have n hermions, calculated to be n squared h bar omega. And then, so here we define that for every single hermions, they have an eigenstate of F1, F2, to F1. And there from Kall's formula, we get the En equals n plus half h bar omega. And from this formula, we can calculate the total energy of n hermions distributed in the first system, the n hermion system, and which is EF equals plus okay, and what do we need to use in this in the proof is that we need to calculate the energy of hermions above the ground level, which is EF minus subtract the E zero, and this we get. This is nothing. Okay, we get energy above the energy level, which is something. And to prove that they are essentially identical, we need to prove that for every system we get the energy above the energy level. And to prove that these three systems are identical, there are essentially three steps we need to do. But for our project, we only for practice we only prove the first step, which is to prove the SO4 Fick Hilbert spaces.
the basis states should be in one-to-one correspondence. Ignore what I just said. It just means that you need to prove that the three systems have the same degeneracy. Okay. Go ahead.
After we did all the mathematical proofs, we have related the duality between the three systems. And the importance of the duality is to show the similarities, which is the degeneracy for the three systems. Okay. Through the process of proving the duality between the three many-body mechanical systems, we learned about many concepts, such as bosons, fermions, duality, the classical simple harmonic oscillator, and the quantization of the harmonic oscillator. Okay, and also the duality between the systems are very important in string theory as well, especially in the context of ADS-CFT correspondence, because this correspondence is an equivalence between the string theory, i.e. quantum gravity, and quantum field theory without gravity. And some of the basic or most common applications of simple harmonic oscillators are the movement of atoms in crystal lattice and sound in crystals.
Okay, thank you for that. We don't have time for questions. If we could have Sean's group up right now, Sean's group. So, now you can all see the importance of time management. So, okay, who's starting off?
Hi. What we want to show in this presentation is the importance of geometry into gravity, into physics. And one simple example is the black hole. To understand the use of geometry in the study of black holes, there is an important and fundamental concept to take in mind. This is the concept of metric. What is the metric? You can think of metric as a list of instructions to calculate the length of curves, and so distances between points. It's easy to think that the knowledge of how calculate distances between points can help us to understand the shape and the curvature of the surfaces. So, basically, when we are in the Euclidean plane, we calculate the distance between points using the Pythagoras theorem. Using this formula. To extend this formula in a case of more complicated spaces, we consider the case of an infinitesimal length to measure. And so we pass to differentials. That are, in some mathematical mean sense, a little little difference between points. So this is the simplest example of a matrix, because it tells us how to calculate distance in between points. There is one another real important case of metric. This is the metric of Euclidean plane in polar coordinates. I think that everyone here know what the polar coordinates are. Simply to say what point is, we say it's distance from the origin, rho, and its angle between the x-axis, theta. The metric of the Euclidean plane in polar coordinates is this. So you can integrate this metric to get the length of any curves. This metric is important because it represents the behavior of space-time in the neighborhood of the event horizon of a black hole. Well, there are many other examples of metric, say the Minkowski metric for the flat space-time. And other representation. Our task is to study the metric of a black hole. The metric of a black hole is given by the Schwarzschild solution that and is this. This seems very complicated, but in the reality, this part is boring. We can this part say us only that we consider a spherical symmetrical solution. These are, in fact, the angles of latitude and longitude in our sphere. R represents the distance from the black hole, and tau represent one sort of time. It's the imaginary time. It's a quantity related to time. Well, 2m, we're working in a unit system where c is equal 1 and g is equal 1, so 2m represent a length, that is the length of the event horizon of a black hole. After this, Mariusz explain what happens to an astronaut in a black hole.
Thank you, Denis. Let's consider a spherical black hole. And an observer who is in a far distance of it. So the curvature of space-time here is almost flat. And this man watches an astronaut falling to the black hole. The question is, what does he see? Using this matrix, which Dennis wrote down, we can see that when the distance from the black hole is very big, this term goes to 1. So when r goes to infinity, we have 2 over infinity, which is 0. And when the distance is becoming smaller, this term goes to 0. Now it's necessary to explain what, in fact, describes this term. we have to hear d tau squared. So then said that tau is a quantity related to time. So in fact, this whole term is the speed of the passage of time. So the distant observer sees his friend fall into the black hole, and when he is going closer and closer, his time is also his time is going slower and slower, and finally stops exactly on the horizon of the black hole, which when and we can see that the speed of the passage is equal to zero, so the time completely stops. So as a conclusion to the situation, we can say that this observer can see his friend hanging on the horizon of the black hole for the infinite time. And the next speaker will explain what really happens with this poor man at the horizon of the black hole.
All right. As he just said, when this distance approaches 2m, there's something, this whole thing approaches zero, and then there's something weird going on. But so to understand that, first of all, let's get into the concept of coordinate singularities. All right, so I'll just use this diagram. We have Euclidean space, Euclidean coordinates, and everybody has the chalk. Yeah, and well, you have something like this to represent a point, and when you have a number and another number, they represent a unique point. And if you change the number, the point is different. If you stay, let x be constant and change the y, you get this. And does everybody know what a polar coordinate is? Well, we have been asked this question 7 times at least. Okay, so for polar coordinate, rho theta, if we keep rho constant and change the theta, we get something like that. But the problem is, when rho is zero, it doesn't matter what theta is. It always represents this very same point. So we have something that's supposed to be a line or a circle collapsing to a point, which is something pretty weird, just like when this approaches 2m, time doesn't matter anymore. But this, so here we got a singularity at the origin for polar coordinates. But the thing is, if we just convert it to Cartesian coordinate, we no longer have this singularity. Therefore, it's just a coordinate singularity. And
okay, so the idea here is, since we've shown fairly easily that this singularity doesn't actually cause any problems, we want to convert the singularity that occurs here at the event horizon into polar coordinates so that we can show that it is only a coordinate singularity and won't cause any real difficulties. To do this, first we'll use a substitution because we're looking at the point where r equals 2m. We use a substitution by setting r equal to 2m plus epsilon, where epsilon over 2m is much less than 1. So then what we'll get for this is 1 minus which can be approximated by binomial expansion as epsilon over 2m. This being the reciprocal is approximately equal to 2m over epsilon, and because r is equal to 2m plus epsilon, we can fairly easily see that dr equals d epsilon. Now, so ignoring this, because as Dennis said, that's boring, what we find is ds squared is equal to, or approximately equal to, epsilon over 2m multiplied by d tau squared plus 2m over epsilon multiplied by d epsilon squared, which, when we look at the fact that epsilon is in the denominator here, and the numerator here, looks very similar to our metric for polar coordinates. So what we want to do is set make this part equal to d rho squared. Okay, which can fairly simply be done by taking the square root of each side. And integrating to get rho equals two radical 2m radical epsilon, or epsilon equals rho squared over 8m. Plugging in, we find we already set this equal to d rho squared. Plugging in for epsilon here, we find that ds squared is equal to rho squared over 16m squared d tau squared plus d rho squared. And it's a fairly simple conversion to make this rho squared. We've already got rho squared here. To make this d theta squared, we simply say tau squared over 16m squared equals theta squared, or tau over 4m equals theta. And we've shown that this metric can be converted into this metric, and the singularity in this metric doesn't cause any significant difficulties.
Okay, so we know that because the event horizon of a black hole is a coordinate singularity and not a true singularity like the one in the center, when this astronaut gets here, he does in fact fall into the hole. He doesn't really feel a major difference in his surroundings compared to this guy who sees him freeze and stops completely. So all the coordinate singularity does is prove that there's a fundamental difference in the perspectives of both these astronauts. And it's just because this guy, because one of them is farther away, the perspective is completely different. And if it was a true singularity, perspective wouldn't be the only problem.
So are there any questions about this? Yeah. No, because we've got 2 root 2. So when we square this whole thing, we get 4, and that's 2. So that's 8. Any other questions? No? Okay.
Yep. Right. switch to this video source?
Video source.
No.
Oh, you have a computer, do you?
Yeah.
I'll get it. Chris, they want to use a video source. Do you have the remote thing to switch to? Can we do that to computer source? Is it down there? Yeah, the touchpad. Okay. Okay. Oh, right. Did they fit?
It looks perfect.
Okay. Okay, yep.
Certainly.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, quiet. Talking now. We did our presentation on quantum memory, and you should all know a little bit about that because we've had presentations on it. And we're going to talk a little bit about how memory works and also compare classical and quantum memory. And there's also some information about what quantum memory would be useful for and then the challenges that come with it. And we did a key point presentation because they're cool. And I'll pass it on so we can get this started.
Okay, first of all, before we are able to understand quantum memory, we should take a look at how classical memory works. Classical memory is what we see nowadays in hard drives, flash memory, all latest technology. We haven't changed yet to quantum memory. The first difference we can see is that classical memory has a lifespan that is by far much greater than what we can achieve up to now with quantum memory. We can have more than 50 years of lifespan, and this is something that yet we can have with quantum memory. It's all about energy and spins. As we have already seen in one of Carlos's presentations and today, the memory is stored with these spins, where an up position and a down position represent different states, and these states are what define the data that is being stored. One of the advantages that we can get, one of the ways we achieve such a huge lifespan with classical memory is that the spins have a tendency to copy their neighbors in whichever position they are at. And this helps a lot. The Ising model is what we use nowadays to represent the classical memory. And it's just because it's a really simple way to represent it. And it's fairly correct comparing to what we see in the experiments. If we get a memory, it could be made in various different ways. We could have a zero-dimensional memory in which each bit is stored in one separate spin. And this is bad because if some interference comes from the outside, this spin could turn around or cause some problems, and there would be no way to recover the data. So it was invented, the one-dimensional spins. And the advantage we get with this is that each spin that turns will cause an energy difference, and this can be really can help a lot to maintain the data. So if we have, we use more than one spin to represent just one bit of data. Now, if this one turns, this will cause an energy of the system to increase, and so the system will try to get to its previous state. So this will automatically turn around, and this is the process we know as the self-healing memories, because it is able to get back to its previous state without us doing nothing. It's the passive self, the passive healing. Now, apart from this is the one-dimensional, we can make this into an array, a two-dimensional spins, and with this we increase a lot the possibilities, and we can get even better results. These are the other possible configurations. The problem which is solved with adding more dimensions is decay. The spins with time, with external factors, they end up changing their orientation, and this is called decay. And this can be modeled according to a mathematical formula which shows exactly what happens. This example is for a zero-dimensional memory, which is the worst case. So you see it gets to the middle where you don't know anything at all. It could be either up or down. This is one thing that I don't think we'll have time to explain, that helps to explain how all these states are possible.
All right, the standard unit of memory for the quantum memory is the qubit, and this is determined by a particle, and it's based on the quantum state of a particle. For example, you have the spin of a nucleus, the spin of an electron, the polarization of a photon, etc. And right now, quantum memory isn't very good. It will last for, if you're lucky, 1 second before it decays. And so one of the goals of quantum memory is to achieve reliable and longer-lasting systems of quantum memory. All right, entanglement is the big thing when it comes to quantum memory, because a qubit and a classical bit are pretty much the same thing until we add this factor of entanglement. The qubit can be represented, as we've seen before, by which means that these basically dictate the probabilities of whether having an up or a down. And that was just a basic way to write out a qubit, but I'm just saying that the entanglement will allow us to teleport information at presumably faster than the speed of light. We have super dense coding, which is you can cut the amount of resources you need to perform computations in half because of superposition. And basically, without entanglement, the qubit is the equivalent of the classical bit. It has the up or it has the down. But thanks to entanglement, we can solve hard mathematical problems like the factoring problem that was discussed earlier.
Okay, so, well, we have some major problems in quantum mechanics. One of the problems we see here, for example, the X error, we have three major errors. X error, Y error, and Z error. X error is that, for example, if we have 9-qubit code, which we will come to later, that let's say three qubits represent one particle, that in this case at the X error, if it appears, it's that one qubit turns around, but you still have 2 qubits which represent your information, so you can still maintain your information. The sad error. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Thank you. So, if you have the sad error, we just switch the plus in between to the minus, which changes our information completely. So the whole information gets lost, and we don't want that, right? So we have to find something that we have to find something where we can have an X error but still maintain our information. And furthermore, if an Y error or a Z error occurs, we still want to maintain our information as well. So right, and then the solution to avoid all those problems is the 9-qubit code. If any of those errors occur, we want to fix those problems. So there are two different ways of curing our memory. We can cure memory in a passive way or in an active way. So what we want mostly is find a passive way, since the active way has to be done by some kind of man-made algorithms. And yeah, so the current passive healing rate is much slower than the rate of errors, which means that, as I will show you, or maybe Tim, that that if you have the 9-qubit code,
all right. So we're working on ways to correct all these errors, the Y error, the Z error, which basically corrupt data. And one of them is to use techniques that we learn how to fix with classical memory and apply them to the new quantum memory. For example, back in classical memory, we showed how if we had one spin that was down compared to 6,000 spins that were up, it would go back to being up. A 9-qubit code, as you can see over there, is you group the qubits in sets of 9 so that if a Z error occurs or an X error occurs, they will follow their nearest neighbor. But the problem with this model is that it's very cumbersome, and it takes, like, especially if 2 errors occur within a short period of time, it won't have time to heal itself properly. So that's why we moved. There's this new way of replacing. There's another solution that we can call the Torah code that's being developed right now. It's a theoretical code for the moment. It doesn't exist in the lab, but this is what we're basically planning to do with it. Back in the old icing model, you would show that you'd have a lattice, and the spins would be on the vertices, and it would have nearest neighbors along these lines. So basically, its neighbor would be here, its neighbor would be here, and That would mean it would be communicating, especially with those ones. In this case, we changed the concept around a little bit. Instead of putting it on the vertices, the spins are located on the lines themselves in the middle, as you can see up there. And each of those, we can call those neighborhoods. Each of those neighborhoods will have a specific energy state. And By the way, the way to correct any errors is to make them very unlikely. To make an error unlikely, you have to make it require a large amount of energy for the system to be in that state of error. So you want the error to need to a lot of energy. So that is very unlikely, as we saw with the canonical ensemble. So because this is a theoretical code, we can do what we want with it. Up there, we set, if there's one conflict in the neighborhood, we set the energy to E0, which varies from system to system. And it doesn't matter if the conflict is up or if it's down. It's just if there's one conflict, it's E0. And the higher E0 is, the less likely that state will be there. So you want all error states to have a very high energy. But if there's two conflicts in the neighborhood, we define it as being zero. And this is a complicated concept, but it will allow us to fix the Z errors, which can occur very insidiously. Because the X error is easy to see. If you have an X error on spins that are polarized upwards, this one will become down, and you will know that it's changed. But as we can see in the Z error, they both stay in their original configurations. The only thing that changes is a sign. And we can't detect that very easily. But if we set the energy to zero, it's too long to explain now, but that will correct the zero. So that's why we use this model. Right now, the only thing that we have for toric model is we have a 2D toric model. So, but the problem with this, 2D, by the way, is in the lattice. It's just like this. The problem with this is that if errors accumulate collinearly in the same line, by the definitions that we described earlier, the total energy of this erratic state will be only, will always be, let's say we have this grid. If the errors are along this line, for example, all those are errors, but their energy is still only 2E0. And this is a problem, because that means that errors can creep in all the time. But a 4D toric model would be the equivalent of a 2D icing. Toric code is equivalent to a 2D icing code, which means that it's a lot more secure. But the problem is we don't have four dimensions of space to make this memory in. So basically, the holy grail for quantum memory right now is to check, is there a 3D toric code that will allow us to save memory securely? But the thing is, it's kind of iffy, because if we follow the patterns that we saw up there, if this is equivalent to a 1D icing model, which means that errors will creep in a lot, or if it's... But it can't be 4D, so can there be something in between? If it follows the pattern, then it'll be like 1.5D, which doesn't exist. So that's our dilemma. And also, we want to create and maintain useful entanglement patterns. Right now, entanglement is very hard to choose which particles, which qubits will entangle with which other qubits. But if we can find a way to really choose the patterns that we want, then that will be a huge improvement. The future of quantum memory. It's speculated that quantum computers using quantum memory will be available within 30 to 50 years. Many people think it's the final frontier of computing, because we can't get smaller than that. But there are limitations. For example, it won't be able to solve certain graph coloring problems, which involve millions and millions of nodes. It won't be able to solve really complex and problems that require a lot of like millions and millions of computation, or trillions or quadrillions of computation, because it won't have enough speed to do so within our life. So that's it. Next slide. And we'd like to say a big thank you to Dr. Carlos Mocon for helping us out with this project. and major props to STMAC as well for being inspiration. Oh, we can't have 40. I just said that it was, we don't have four dimensions of space. Sorry? No, I mentioned that it was theoretical, but it wouldn't be impossible because we don't have four dimensions of space. But it would be nice because it would really eliminate a lot of errors that we have in data.
Hello. Okay. So we are the Pilot Wave Theory Group. Our mentor was Ward. I don't think Ward is here right now, but I'd just like to give a shout out to him just for clearing all of our minds. It's a brilliant thing, really. So thanks, Ward, wherever you are, probably in your office. Pilot Wave Theory is, I guess, just an alternative approach to quantum theory using hidden variables. Now, what you will find and what we will explain is that taking this approach will allow for some very interesting consequences. I guess just a quick history on pilot wave theory, very quick, developed by a guy named de Broglie, perfected by a guy named Baum in 1952, I believe, a paper was written on it. And it was based on some proposals and ideas that I guess originally Einstein had and had conflicted with quantum theory. But I guess Einstein didn't want to conflict with his own theories, like special relativity, so he just kind of backed out on this one. Let somebody else handle it. So there are two major things that pilot wave theory will allow for that we are going to focus on today. One is that it allows for a type of non-local communication. And this is even of classical information, not just an entangled state, but it uses an entangled state in a specific way to allow for the transfer of classical information through non-local correlations. And I guess the big kahuna of pilot wave theory, the reason why it's so different, so radical, is that it gets rid of superposition. There are no longer particles in two places at once. And no matter who studies quantum theory for how long, nobody can actually claim to understand how something can be in two places at once without using some kind of manipulated mathematical model. So the advantage of pilot wave theory is it gives us a more proper conceptual picture as well as giving us the same results mathematically that quantum theory does. So to explain a little bit more about the mathematics and the concept of hidden variables, I guess I'll pass it over to my esteemed colleague, Matt, here, is the resident mathematical expert of the Pilot Thievery team.
Hi. What you have here is Schrodinger's equation, a bunch of weird, tricky stuff. This is the basic idea of what pilot wave theory works on. And thanks to Schrodinger, we can do that. OK, I'm going to start with what are hidden variables. There is a theory that says that are certain positions of particles in space that we cannot detect nor we can measure, which is hidden variables. If we could measure them, we could determine anything we want at any certain time, at any given place or position or whatever idea you have about one particle in space. So this is hidden variables. Okay. Now I'm going to have to look at this because it's big. We start with Schrodinger's wave equation, I with whatever that is. And we take whatever that is and keep going down to have a final wave function, which is long and tedious to do. I actually tried last night to solve this equation. It took me 5 minutes to realize that it's nearly impossible. Not impossible, very, 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 very hard to do. And below we have the movement formula, which is Newton's formula, actually. And because we're extremely lazy, I didn't write down all the transformation I need to do to get to the final thing. So if we take the general idea of general formula for waves, which is psi equals r of as in magnitude times e at I s something. If we take that and put it in Schrodinger's equation, we can split it in real and imaginary, and we can actually determine the wave function. But to determine a wave function, we need an initial state, which is t naught. So if we have a t naught, we can determine the wave function. This is generally the mathematics we've all been taught here. We all understand it, I hope. This is all about mathematics. If you just take this and solve all the equations, if you have the time or if you feel the need to, I don't. You can will end up solving most of the things pilot wave theory says, and it gets rid of superposition, and it allows faster than light to travel. So, this is all about mathematics and invariables. Now I'm going to pass it along to I don't know who. Thank you.
Okay. We all know the two-slit experiment, and it's usually used as a really good example of why quantum theory is necessary to explain what we see in the real world. But it's also explainable using pilot wave theory. In quantum theory, it's generally accepted that the wave function, the particle goes from the source to one of the slits, and then at that point it basically becomes a wave or a wave function until it hits something or until its wave function is collapsed. But in pilot wave theory, there's actually, because the equation, the Schrodinger wave equation, has been separated into a wave-like aspect and a particle-like aspect, there is both a particle and a wave. And the wave function can be interpreted both as a force and a probability density, because it's numerically equivalent to a probability density, as well as being an actual force. So what that amounts to is the wave function is going along like this, and then it goes through these two slits, and it interferes with itself, and the particle basically just rides out the waves. Creating the interference pattern that we see. You get the initial momentum using this equation here. Though, as you can see, I've written it down. In practice, we don't actually control the initial momentum because it's too difficult. There's like no way to do it. There's this funky equation here because U, which is the quantum mechanical potential, which is another force that acts on it, because the wave function behaves similarly to a gravitational field or something like that. That's acting on it, and because it becomes infinite when r becomes zero, basically the particles are never found where there's no wave function. Anyway, so who's next? Okay, so I don't care, mind. Either way, if you.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about entanglement in the pilot wave theory. So basically, whenever we have a little system set up where there's a source in the center sending two particles to the detectors, and we have detector A and detector B on either side, whenever a particle, so basically two particles are emitted and they hit either of the detectors, and the detectors analyze the particles and can ask them two questions, or three questions, and there's different variations of questions that they can ask. And when they're asking questions, they need to satisfy two major rules. And the first rule is that whenever both A and B are asked the same question, the answers must be the same. And the second rule is that the total number of mismatched answers between A and B must be equal to the total number of matched answers. So, for example, if question one is asked to the detector A, and at the same time question one is asked to detector B, they will both have to have the exact same answer. Whereas if question two is asked to detector A and question one is asked to detector B, then they may have different answers. And so, as you probably already realized, there's exactly 9 combinations of questions that can be asked to both the particles. And that's a little grid to demonstrate that. And since there's only 9 possible ways, this defies the second rule, which states that the number of matching answers must equal the number of mismatching answers, because if there's 9 possible combinations, then it turns out that there's 4 different answers and 5 matching answers. So what we have to do to actually satisfy the condition is repeat the steps a whole bunch of times, an infinite number of times, basically, so that the answers vary enough times and also equal each other enough times so that the two rules are satisfied. And basically, to be able to do this, the detectors, the particles need to be able to communicate with each other so that they can determine which answer to give. And so I'm going to pass it to Alyssa now, and she's going to explain how the particles can interact with each other and give the correct answer to satisfy both rules. Thank you.
Okay, so you all remember how when we went to the park, we did the experiment where we all have to be the photons that magically agree, and it's impossible to do because we're not magic photons. So, yeah, the photons communicate to each other and they agree. But is there a practical application of this? Can we use this photon signaling to send signals between each other faster than light? So, who thinks you can? Hands up. Okay, you're wrong. Sure. Okay, and the reason why you're wrong is because, see, A and B don't know each other's results without talking to each other normally, and if they're doing that, it kind of defies the point of fast and light communication. And you can't have, say, A run over here to the source and set the variables however they want so that B will find the results, because having someone measure at the source completely destroys the entanglement, so B just gets random gibberish. And the reason why it works this way is because there is an assumed initial condition in pilot wave theory, which is equilibrium. And Yuri will explain equilibrium.
Okay, who knows what's equilibrium? Hands up. Nobody knows. Oh, okay, that's good. That's not that bad. So when you look behind you, you see that that's not equilibrium. Most of you are sitting here in the front, and equilibrium is when the most, when all of the particles have
the sum of all of the particles, momentum and force, equals zero. So I'll show it on a simple example. When you have a pot of water at some temperature, and when you put something very hot inside, you have a big difference in temperature, and that's not equilibrium. But it, with time, it becomes the same temperature, so you have equilibrium. So that's the same thing with space. In the beginning, there was probably no equilibrium. So there was no equilibrium in the beginning, but with time, we got equilibrium. So when you are talking about the pilot wave theory, equilibrium is very important, because the pilot wave theory works only when there is equilibrium. We can show it with a double slit experiment. So if the particle has its, most of the particles in the beginning don't have the same momentum, the sum of momentums isn't zero, most of the particles could go in one direction. So in that case, we won't get a wave function as we usually get, but we'll get a different wave function. For example, if most of them go to this half, there will be a slight difference. So, but when there is equilibrium, the results are the same as with the bias. I will give my mic.
Okay, so basically, in space near us and on Earth, we live in an equalized state due to entropy, which is an increase in randomization. And if we have completely random particles, they all kind of go like that. So they take all the possible paths through these openings, and then they're determined by the wave function. But if we were to find non-equalized spot in very deep, very early space, where there isn't a lot of matter to interact and create an equalized space, then we could have like most of them over here, which would give us a lot going like that and a lot going like that, but nothing in there or in there. That's probably not the right wave, but you get the idea. And we can use this non-equilibrium to get faster-than-light communication. And we can do this because of the properties of the interactions of waves. Because the wave functions, if you have a one-particle system, they work in three-dimensional space. But if you have two particles, like our experiment here, where there's one in either direction, the waves are actually in six dimensions, which means they interfere in symmetrical systems, but not in asymmetrical systems. And so what that means in pictures is, say you add mirrors to reflect your waves into the particles. And over here is A, over here is B. If it's symmetrical, the waves interfere here and here, causing the particle, if it's taken this path, to go up like that, and if it to bounce like that. And you can basically imagine it like the two waves are coming together, and then the two troughs meet. So the particles are not going to go over the highest point of the wave. They're going to continue down in the lowest part. So it helps if you visualize it like a cork on water waves. Anyway, but in an equilibrium state, there's still a 50% chance up and a 50% chance down. So it doesn't matter if we change it so that, see, in this one there's no mirrors, so A is up and B is up. And in this one, there are mirrors, so A is down and B is up. But if you get non-equilibrium, so it's, say, 70-30, then you would get at A 70% down and 30% up. And you can change the equilibrium so that you would get 100% up and 0% down, say. And then B can add or remove the mirrors to change the outcomes at A. So if B has the mirrors and sets at a greater probability up, then A will also have a greater probability up. And if B has the mirrors, then if B has a greater probability up, A has a greater probability down. So we can use this and say that down for A is 1 and up is 0. And then we can, and then B can add or remove the mirrors and send, say, a series of zeros and ones, just as in classical information, faster than light. But this requires a non-equalized state, so it's unlikely we'll be seeing this in, say, cell phones anytime soon. And we have a short recap.
Well, I just like to say, in conclusion, pilot wave theory offers an alternate explanation for the weird workings of the quantum world. The mathematics are generally similar. You just split up the equation and it the hidden variable thing, and it calls for unlocalized or delocalized correlations. But the most important part, compared to quantum theory, pilot wave theory has no superposition, so, as seen above. Conceptually, it just means that instead of the particle being at two places at the same time, as only its wave function splits up, the particle only ever follows one path. This is so much easier to understand. So pilot wave theory just makes sense.
So that's our presentation. Magnetic field. Okay, like a magnetic field. So I think it's instantaneous and it sort of happens at all times. I should probably check this actually. Yeah.
The basic idea for wave function, it doesn't travel in three-dimensional space, it travels in configuration space. In configuration space, there is possible for faster than light speed travels. Therefore, there is an instantaneous transfer of information. Therefore, wave does travel faster than light. Any questions left? David. It's not an experiment, it's mathematics. We're in a physics camp with theoretical physics, right? We don't do experiments.
The three main assumptions of particle wave pilot wave, right? that the psi field satisfies Schrodinger's equations, that the particle momentum is restricted to p equals change in s x. Oh no, never mind. but yeah, and that we don't predict or control the precise location of the particle, but have in practice a statistical ensemble with probability density px psi x squared. But it's the first one that's important because, and also, okay, never mind. I was going to say that means that it behaves the same way that it would in quantum mechanics, but you get to be able to visualize what's actually happening rather than just banishing it to philosophy.
Who's our leader? Matt, are you the leader? Just somebody, just keep an eye on me. So I'll put on the
leader.
Hi. Our group will be talking about Ponzano regime module. The Honorable Jonathan Hackett is the person behind all this interesting stuff. Using grasping, we will find the area of a tetrahedron. Tetrahedrons are used to fill the space. Tetrahedrons are used to represent space because enough tetrahedrons that are really small can fill any space. The notations J1, J2, The notations J1, J2, J3, and J4, J5, and J6 are used to represent the edge length and the variables A, B, and C all represent a variable edge length. So when dealing with this Ponzano regime model, we use two rules to transform the knots.
I'm just going to be expanding on what Satyal said to us, or said to all of you. Basically, what we do, we represent space with triangles because they're the simplest shape. You can't have a shape with two sides. What happens, space is three-dimensional, so we use three-dimensional triangles or tetrahedrons. Artist's conception of a tetrahedron is this. As you can see, we have the top view and the bottom view. Okay, maybe it's not an artist's conception. It looks more like a monkey with a crayon's conception, but enough. And what we do, to manipulate our space, what we do, we add edges or sides or lines or whatnot to these tetrahedrons.
And we do this by manipulating what's called the projection of a tetrahedron. This is basically all the lines of a tetrahedron put down on a two-dimensional space. And we just manipulate the connections and pathways on the tetrahedron to add whatever it is we really please. And now, Candice, she's going to explain somewhat how the mathematics works.
So these are the six J symbols. Okay. So the first one is the tetrahedral written differently. And what we do is we basically modify it until we get to a line. That's what we basically want in the end. And so what we do is we go over to the next step, and as you can see, the top one is J1, and it is connected to J6 and J5 as it was in the first one, and same with J6 was connected to J2 and J4, and J5 was connected to J4 and J3. And then we go to the next one, and again we modify it, and J5 and J3 and J4 were all connected in the previous one, so therefore they're connected again. And same as J6, J2, and J4 were connected, so now they're connected again. And then the next one, we have J3 and J2 are connected with E. And E is just a variable that represents the length of an edge. And then J5 and J6 are connected to E as well. And then the next step, that would be step 5, we have J3 and J2 are connected to E, just as in the previous step. And then E is connected to J5 and J6, just as in the previous step. And then we have J1. And J1 was gone from steps 3 and 4 because we don't need J1 at that time. So J1 just gets put back in step 5. And then we go on to the next step. And J3 and J2 are connected to J1, just as the previous step. And then it just keeps going, and J1 is connected to J2 and J3. And then J2 is connected to J1 and J3. And then J2 is connected to J1, and J1 is connected to J3. And then we get a semicircle with J1, and then we just get a line with J1. And that's the process.
So we have this tetrahedron. We've added three lines, so we've added a corner. And by solving this back to a tetrahedron, we get J6 groups. And we use mathematical steps to thereby determine, knowing the lengths of J1 through J6, the area of the tetrahedron.
And just one important thing to point out maybe is, through our 2D model here, the reason that we're using recombination techniques is to actually, in essence, eliminate the graspings here. And the tetrahedron itself is actually just the four-sided figure, not the five-sided. I think we just mixed that up a bit. But without further ado.
Well, basically, the problem that we're given by our mentor, John, was to take this two-dimensional structure into a four-sided tetrahedron. Now, basically, what you do here is you see we have the six J's, and what we basically need is the six J's, and we don't need the ones, and ones because we've got three of them already. Now, what we do, we have to have six lines in our final structure. Now, to have six lines in our final structure, we have to eliminate this one here, and one here. So what I will do, I'll eliminate the first one, and then John and Matthew will then eliminate the other two. So if you look carefully at the structure, you'll find that from J1 is connected to J3. From this portion of the structure, it's connected to J3. Then it goes to J2, and then from there it goes to 1, and then continues to continues this line J2 is J2 there. Now with the rules that were given, they were written here, don't just wrap them, but I'll just give a basic outline. Now from here, from the rules that were given, what we do is we resolve this by what we call graphical transformation. Now, with the first step, in this case, we'll then have the structure wherein we have our J1 here, and then because J1 is connected to J3, we'll then have J3 here, and J1 is then connected to J2, and as the line continues, J2 is also there. So here we'll also have J2, and here we'll have 1, which is this line here. Now, this according to the second rule, if you can see there, the second move is where you have to you flip this 2, and then from here you introduce a certain variable wherein you want to eliminate the connection between J2 and 1, because you don't need this much because they're extra graspings, and we want to have a four-sided figure. So what we do here, we'll then have to flip the structure. J1 and 1 will then remain in the same position, but what happens here is that J2 then moves here, and then here we'll have our J3. Now, after this, because this is used to find the area of the tetrahedron, we'll then have to put this in the form of a matrix. Now, the matrix, we've got A there, sorry. Looks like a matrix, but it's not really a matrix. And then from here, we've got A. A can be anything. And this, the function of A here is just to remove the connection between J2 and 1, because we don't need 1. So when we come to writing our J's in this sequence, we'll then have J1, J3, and then the one in the middle, that's J2. And then from there, we'll then have J2, 1, and A. That is just the basic representation of what happened here. Now, Matthew will then continue with removing the second one.
Great, okay. Okay, so I'm just going to use the same structures that he did, and now that we've actually got rid of this tie here, now we can actually approach the situation in a similar sense but from a different side.
If you saw in that last diagram, we actually disconnected. This was J2, and the length 1 over there was connected to J2. In this move, we undid that. We connected it to the variable A. So we can put A where we want it. So I'm going to put A down here. And this line now goes down there. And that line stays as 1.
Okay. So we approach the same 2D model from a different sense now. So trying to create the same figure here through this model, we can kind of get the 2 upper arms here, the body, and then the lower 2 arms there, if you can kind of imagine turning that. And what you get there is therefore J1, J5, and then J6, J6, and 1 again. So that becomes, by the rules that we have on the far board, these two here will stay the same, and these two will switch. So it'll give you J1, and 1 won't move, and J6 and J5 will switch. And we put a second variable in to represent that. And the projection from this then will be J1, J5, J6, J6, 1, and then B. And then John will do the third one.
Okay. So we did the exact same thing here as we did on the bottom. We disconnected this from J6 and made it to B. So I'm going to put B up here, and the value of that line is still 1.
So now I'm just gonna deal with this part, because I can separate them, manipulate them, as long as I put them back together. So here's what I've got. I've got B1, 1, 1, J1, and J1, and A. But again, I'm just going to take this part, and I'm going to use one of these moves. You can see here, here's one side. It's connected to J1 and 1, and that 1 is connected to 1 and 1 again. So that's the same thing as that. And then again, I can use that move over there. There. So I've disconnected one from one there, and I get my 6J series of numbers. So it's J1, B1, 1, 1, and C. Can someone? So I've got that, but I've got it put back the A that I took out before. Or no, the J1 that I left out, sorry. So I didn't draw this very well, but basically I just flipped it, and because the J1 is connected to both B and 1, there's where I had to put it. Then I use a second rule. We called it the bubble rule, which was when you have J1, X, Y, and A, that's all equal to J1. So I'll take this part, because that's the bubble. And that's all equal to J1. So I input J1 back into there. I'm going to go back to the bubble move. I did that wrong. Okay, I drew that completely wrong. I'm sorry. I've got B, J1, 1, and C, which is all equal to B. So I've got B, J1, and 1. And that is equal to something like that, with B, J1, and 1, which is equal to, because J1 touches, J1 touches both sides. So it's equal to J1, B1, and C, and J1. So that is therefore equal to J1. So I took this whole right-hand side and showed that it was equal to J1. Therefore, I've gone back to my tetrahedron. So I've completed that move. Now I go back to where I last used this move. And I then have the 6J. I have B, J1, 1, 1, 1, and C. But because B, A, and C are all variables, I could prove this, but I'm running out of time. They're all equal. So A equals B equals C, but I'm going to call them the constant K. So I've got these. Okay, so I've got those three, and then I need to take one from this one, from my final part. And that is that's K, J2, J3, J4, J5, and J6. So I've got those four. I need to multiply them together with a big long constant. Which is that. Yeah. And there are a whole bunch of rules for multiplying together J6 series, which I do not have time to show you. But once you do it, the final answer is that bottom part. So if anyone would like to do it and prove me wrong, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess just what we can get at before we finish is it's really hard to portray it through this sense unless you've actually been exposed to it and try it yourself. So as you can see, like, it's really trying to represent mathematics, which are pretty complex, I think. So the general sense you got to take away from it is just that you're using a 2D model of a tetrahedron to figure out the volume of a either difficult geometric shape or anything like that. So it's just to show the value in using tetrahedrons in general. So thanks.
Dennis.
Okay, so basically, what quantum gravity can postulate is that space, we can represent space as tetrahedrons. This is a way of manipulating those tetrahedrons, because
number of tetrahedrons in a certain space, and you know the size,
whatever volume of the tetrahedrons, you obviously can figure out the volume of the entire space.
Well, guys, it's going to be amazing when you look back at this video. Take yourselves back a couple of weeks, and you'll be amazed at how much you actually have learned in the 6 hours. So I have to give kudos to the mentors to be able to impart to you the knowledge required to be able to demonstrate what you just did. It is very difficult. You found out that time runs at a different rate when you're doing a presentation. There must be a theory about that. What we're going to do now, you guys are going to get your afternoon tea break. So you can leave your materials down here. When you go upstairs, and you'll be going upstairs probably to collect your t-shirts as well, remember there are people working. So use common sense, common courtesy, and a quiet voice, i.e. probably no voice at all, and go up the stairs, and Sonia will be up the stairs meeting you there. So enjoy your tea break. We'll be back down here by about 3:30. Thank you.